Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
To HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. This next interview is a post-dated one, so some of the events referred to may already have passed. In this segment of our show, we'll be hearing from Lanier Tunji Ajayi. We'll be telling us a little bit about sickle cell. So, can you tell me a little bit about your work with sickle cell?
Yeah, so, sickle cell disease is a genetic blood disorder and the most common genetic blood disorder. It predominantly affects individuals who identify as black, even though it also affects other cultures, including the South Americans, South Asians, and people from the Middle East, the Mediterranean, and so on and so forth. However, throughout the world, it's known that sickle cell disease predominantly affects individuals who identify as black. In many parts of the world, including North America, there's a lot of stigma attached to the disease. You find that people are branded and stigmatized as drug sick many times when they do appear in hospitals looking for, treatment for vaso-occlusive crisis, which is one of the complications of the disease. And so, for us, it's very important to destigmatize the disease, number one, raise awareness, because with more awareness, with more education provided around this disease, it will really help to reduce the stigma that will suffer. They suffer stigma at work. Many do not even want their employers to know, because if the employer knows, they may no longer have a job. It's really that bad. Sickle cell disease comes with a lot of complications. It damages the vital organs of the body. You find that many individuals living with the disease have end organ damage by the time they are like about 40-something years old. It also causes premature death, right? You find that the average lifespan of an individual with sickle cell disease of an individual with sickle cell disease compared to their peers is about 25 years less. Because of this, as an organization, it becomes very important for us to really, work to improve awareness and also to reduce the stigma that the affected people have to suffer and also the complications. So what do we do? Number one, we offer education. We know that with more knowledge, people will be able to manage the disease better in order to improve their own quality of life. So we have disease management sessions that we offer to families, not only in Canada, but globally. People can tap in. They are done virtually. We also have the healthcare providers. Education program whereby we are helping to improve the knowledge of the healthcare providers around the disease. You might be amazed that in a country, as Canada or even in the US or UK, not to talk about in the third world countries, you find that many of the care providers still have very limited knowledge around this disease. So do our part to also help educate the healthcare providers. We are very involved in research. We know that without research, there would not be a cure. So not only do we support, you know, clinical research and support recruitment of families into research, we also conduct our own psychosocial research project. We raise funds towards research as well. One of the research that we've done is to, first of all, identify the number of people in the province of Ontario that lives with this disease. So we've done a lot of different other research, and we also have a research actually that we are working on right now around COVID-19 and sickle cell disease.
Just wondering, how do you go about reaching out to those affected by sickle cell?
So we have a collaborate with the centers of excellence. So for instance, we have hospitals, about 7 hospitals that are designated centers in the province, for instance, that focus on sickle cell disease. So we do work with them, and so they would tell patients about our organization as a place that they can seek psychosocial support and so on and so forth. We also ally with many other organizations in the community, and so people refer people to us. And that's how people know about the programs. Of course, through online as well, people can look at what are the organizations in the province, and maybe there are newcomers into the province or into the country. They can look it up, and they can find our organization, and they can connect with us. Some of the things that we do for the individuals with the disease is also we create a WhatsApp forum, which is very important in helping people to connect with other people. As I mentioned earlier, sickle cell disease is a disease that's surrounded by stigma. And so people being able to come together, you know, and being able to meet other people and share how they deal and cope with the disease is also very important. So we created that forum, and, you know, to allow them to be able to have that opportunity. We also have a Facebook group chat that they can also chat in there and support one another there. Basically, we are an advocacy and psychosocial support organization. We provide scholarship to young people who are pursuing post-secondary education and so on and so forth. So these are some of the things that we do. And of course, we advocate on their behalf with the government, with the workplace, and with schools.
So what are some of the common barriers caused by the myths you alluded to earlier about sickle cell? Someone were to discriminate in employment, for example.
So there are barriers, and so again, because many individuals with sickle cell disease do get sick very often, especially if they are not on comprehensive care program or they are not seeing a specialist who is closely monitoring them. Sickle cell disease could be debilitating, it could cause frequent hospitalization, and sometimes hospitalization could be from just maybe 1 week or even 2 months, right? And so this is one of the reasons why maybe some employers are a little bit, uncertain if they should be employing individuals with sickle cell disease. However, with the progressing treatment that we have right now, you find that people with sickle cell disease, for instance, who are on hydroxyurea, they don't get sick like that. But you see, people don't know that. And because, for instance, hydroxyurea is a medication that modifies the sickle blood to make it as close to a normal blood as possible. When you then have your sickle blood be as close to a normal blood, a normal round cell, as close as possible, it then reduces the frequency of, you know, crises and other complications and so on that one with the disease may have. And so they are able to have improved quality of life. They are able to go to work, be a mother, be a father, be a girlfriend, be whatever they want to be. But if people don't know that, they think, oh, you have sickle cell disease, and so you will not be functioning, you will not be able to be effective at your job. And so it's a myth, like you say. These things, there are people with sickle cell disease who are doing well at their job, and they're coping well even with their disease.
So do you know offhand about how many people are affected by sickle cell?
So in Canada, we can document about 6,000. We know there are more. We have about 6,000 across the country, and in the province of Ontario, about 3,500 people.
So in your time providing support for those affected, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
Very good. So every time we can reach. So there are a few success moments, and one of them is the ability to reach the policymakers in them making a change in policy. That's always standing out. So I'll give you. In 2017, we were able to get the parliament, to enact June 19 as National Sickle Cell Day Canada. What does that do? That allowed a lot of the politicians to go and learn what is sickle cell, what is sickle cell disease, who does it affect, how does it affect the people, and that in itself is raising awareness. And there was a lot of support for the bill. In the same token, we did a similar work in Ontario last year, and we got the province of Ontario to also enact June 19 as Provincial Sickle Cell Awareness Day, which again helped to raise awareness around the disease at Queen's Park. And of recent, we just got the Ministry of Health to provide funding to the Centers of Excellence in Ontario for staffing. And that is important because if you have comprehensive programs in hospitals and you don't have funding to support this comprehensive program, what's the point? So being able to have those advocacy successes stands out for me. And number two, when we, over the years, over 17 years, been doing this work, and when you hear patients say, because of the work that we do, because of the education sessions and the disease management program that they were part of, they've been able to improve on their own health status, their quality of life, their quality of health. Those are very successful moments, right? When you think about it, to say, okay, what you're doing is actually having an impact. Patients are living longer, they're having healthier lives, they have improved quality of life, they have information that they don't have before. People who say, well, I'm an introvert, I don't connect, but yet they join the forum and they're connecting, and you know, it also improved their psychosocial well-being, their mental health state. These are examples of successes in my mind of, you know, what we've done and how we've impacted this community.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Thank you.
Of course. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Lee Reavy, NCBRS Worldwide Foundation. So, can you tell me a little bit about the foundation's work?
Yeah, of course. Would you like me to start off with how we started?
Certainly.
Yeah, so basically, I'll go back to the beginning. My son was born in 2006. Straight away, we knew there was something a little bit different than usual. Our local hospital done loads of genetic testing. Everything come back negative. He was then referred to Great Ormond Street Hospital in London, in UK. He was sent for 5 days intensive testing, and he was just seen luckily by two geneticists who were working at GOSH at the time, and said he fits a description of this rare syndrome. Anyway, fast forward a few months, he was clinically diagnosed with this condition, and he was the seventh child in the world to be diagnosed with it. Fast forward to 2010, and we held our first conference in the UK, which consisted of six families from the UK and three from around Europe, and included the two geneticists from Great Ormond Street Hospital in London. This grew substantially to our last meeting in 2018, to 26 families attending from around the world. In 2015, we had a family join us from Canada, from Ontario. We've actually become like lifelong friends now, and in 2020, this is when the NCBRS Worldwide Foundation was established. So we are a registered charity in the UK, and we support anyone around the world who is affected by Nicolaides-Baraitser syndrome.
So, for those who might not be as familiar, how does the syndrome typically affect a person?
So the main characteristics include epilepsy, short stature, developmental delay, intellectual disability. Roughly around a third of cases will have some type of scoliosis. It's characterized by them symptoms.
So you mentioned it's a rare condition. Do you know offhand about how many people they suspect have it?
So to the foundation known to us, we've got just over 260 families, so 260 people diagnosed with the condition known to us, and obviously we support their families as well, and care and the carers, etc. But in literature, there's only, well, there's less than 100 described in literature.
So what sorts of supports do you provide to someone who's just dealing with a new diagnosis? They're wondering, what does this mean for me or my child or my family?
So what we tend to do is we do one-to-one support. So obviously they would reach out to us. We would be their one-to-one support as well. And we also have a private family group. So this consists of all of our families from around the world. And it is a private group where newly diagnosed and our currently diagnosed people will be in. And they share experiences, ask for support, ask questions. That is the main source of support for our families at the moment.
So I'd imagine with mirroring signs of epilepsy and short stature, there's a chance for misdiagnosis.
Absolutely. We truly believe there are many more diagnosed with this condition around the world, and it is just a case of not getting a diagnosis or being misdiagnosed.
So if you're comfortable sharing your own story as a parent, when you...
Yep.
When you found out that your son had this, what sort of coping mechanisms did you use to try and keep a cool head and find out the next steps?
So, I will start off by saying I was 19 years old when my son was born with this condition. And being told that your son has a rare disease and not even the doctors knowing a lot about it themselves, it was a strange feeling, but we had a very good support network around us, including like my wife's family, my family. Our friends were very supportive as well, and they was always there for us. But I think the main thing that kept us going was we were always in contact with them two geneticists from Great Ormond Street. You know, they was always at the end of the phone or at the end of an email. My son was actually part of future research projects going forward as well as part of this condition. So knowing that we were able to be a part of that to help someone else in the future, I think that's what kept us going.
So in your time with the foundation, what's been the greatest success you've experienced?
For me personally, it would be bringing all of our families together when we had our in-person conferences before COVID. Just bringing them people together, the emotions by everybody, you know, it can feel very isolating having a rare disease. So being able to finally meet someone who has the same condition as your child or as you, and then, you know, having that time with them families as well who are going through them same lived experiences, I just think that is one of the highlights that I could say for me personally, being able to bring all them people together.
So I'd imagine that with the conferences, meeting someone under those conditions, they forge lasting bonds, that they don't just meet at the conference, talk a little bit. When they go back, they would stay in touch, share insights.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I would, so from our very first conference in 2010, we still in regular contact with the family who come there, and they're actually like our friends as well. So we meet up outside of the foundation and outside of the cottages, and we just become very close friends as well. It is like an extended family, and you just sort of get on and you click.
So do you have any advice for someone who's dealing with a new diagnosis and is taking that first step?
Obviously, it can be very daunting when you get a new diagnosis, and especially a rare disease diagnosis as well. I would say always reach out for support, but only when you feel comfortable in doing so. And don't be afraid to ask the difficult questions. Because at the end of the day, that's why we're here, to support people in their diagnosis journey. And don't be afraid to reach out to the medical professional world as well for advice and answers.
I'd thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
No problem.
Andy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Hey CJAM listeners, looking for more ways to connect with CJAM programming? Try streaming CJAM through iHeartRadio. Listen online, download the iHeartRadio app, or use your smart speaker. OK Google, play CJAM on iHeartRadio. No matter where you are, experience CJAM FM on higher ground.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard a little bit about sickle cell from Lanier Tunji Ajayi, and Lee Reavy told us a little bit about NCBRS. This next interview contains mature subject matter. Listener discretion is advised. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Lori Harrell, Paul Regan of the Roe Foundation. Can you tell me a little bit about the work of the Roe Foundation?
Well, the Roe Foundation was established back in 2014, along with OWP Pharmaceuticals, as a pharmaceutical social enterprise. The goal being to use a large proportion, about half, of the profit realized by OWP to address issues of epilepsy around the world, particularly in under-resourced countries. Our operating definition for under-resourced would be countries that are designated as low and middle income, so don't have access to technology and training and treatment.
In that sense, what are some of the risks for someone with epilepsy who wouldn't be able to get what we consider the best method of treatment?
Well, for children, it's particularly harmful to live with untreated seizures. Children's brains that are developing are at risk for permanent damage, which can have various ramifications, cognitive abilities, learning abilities, and so on. And then anybody living with untreated seizures is at a much higher risk of death than the general population. I believe it's 2 to 3 times higher. So it's a serious issue. And then there's also the matter of secondary injuries, especially in some low-income countries where people are gathering water from an open well or cooking over an open fire. You can imagine that having a seizure is extremely dangerous because the person who's seizing would not be able to remove themselves from that danger.
So I'm curious, some of these countries, do you ever encounter any myths or misperceptions about what epilepsy really is and what it means?
Definitely. There's a lot of misunderstanding. Many people aren't aware that epilepsy is a medical condition of the brain, and so due to its unknown origin, it's often assigned under the heading of a spiritual possession, demon possession, or perhaps a spiritual punishment, a curse in the family. It takes many forms, and it can be a life-threatening situation. We've heard of at least one story where a man was burned to death by people in his village because of his believed connection with demon possession.
Yeah,
because he had epilepsy.
And also the mistaken belief that it's a contagious disorder, so that having a person in the community with epilepsy puts a community at risk. Of course, we know that to be false, but in many areas of the world, that's people's understanding.
So curious, this spurning case, where was this?
That was in Malawi several years ago. That was well documented in international news, I believe reported in papers in Europe and so on. But we know there's plenty of cases of abuse and crime committed against people having seizures for various reasons, their vulnerability, as well as these matters that we just discussed. But there's many cases of that happening.
So I'd imagine with the foundation working internationally, you have to establish a lot of partnerships with local medical practitioners and just community agencies.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. When ROW first started, we realized that it was senseless to try to reinvent the wheel. If good work was already being done, then we would partner with that and find partners to develop additional good works. So from day one, Ken, we decided that we wanted to stay in close step with at least three global organizations. One is the International League Against Epilepsy. The other one is the International Bureau for Epilepsy. And the third is World Health Organization. And so we spoke with representatives of those organizations to find out what their assessment of the global cost of epilepsy was, what their programming priority areas were, and then to try to work in concert with their aims and their goals to maximize everyone's effect. So that's how we started out, and as we grew and acquired new partners, we're actually doing programming around the world, of course, you get exposure to even additional partners, and we found that that is the most effective way to do work, is to partner with those who are already doing the work, or who are so aligned with you that you can walk in step with them to maximum effect.
So, in that sense, in your time with the foundation, what's been the greatest success you've witnessed?
That's for you, Lori.
Oh boy, there's a lot of good ones to share. I would say one of our longer running partnerships is with an organization in Houston called Cuatro por Venezuela. And this is an organization that provides relief of various types, medical, food, school supplies, and basic necessities. Those goods are shipped from the U.S. to Venezuela. And so we partner with them to provide quantities of anti-seizure medications and also a medication that can be used for psychiatric conditions, due to the severe economic situation there. People just don't have access. Hospitals don't have access to everything they need. So we've been supplying medication through that organization to Venezuelans in need. This is our fifth year, I believe, or we've been doing this for 5 years. And so knowing that we're able to reach a hard-to-reach country with aid is very meaningful to us, and just knowing the difficulties that people with epilepsy face, if we're able to provide relief in that, ongoing struggle, all the other areas that people still struggle there, if we can provide that type of peace of mind, we're very pleased with that.
Yeah, another great one is our partnership with TeleEEG in the UK. Can you share that one, Lori, too?
Sure. So, as your listeners may know, one route commonly used in upper-income countries to definitively diagnosing epilepsy is with an EEG study. And EEG equipment is difficult to access in these low- and middle-income countries, especially in rural areas. If you live outside of the capital city or the big trade center, you're probably not going to have any access to that. And even in those areas, it can be hard to access. So we've partnered with a UK charity, TeleEEG, and they provide epilepsy diagnosis by telemedicine. And so they're able to, through their donors' support and partnering with organizations like Roe Foundation, for low cost, we can get basic EEG equipment into a clinic or hospital. TeleEEG trains the staff on how to use that equipment and how to upload EEG studies to the cloud. And then TeleEEG has a network of volunteer interpreters who can interpret the study and provide a diagnosis and treatment plan for the clinic or hospital location.
So where can people go about finding out more information about the work you do?
Well, we'd be happy to have them visit our website, which is Roe Global, ROWGlobal.org.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank you both for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. You know, my friends, the tragedies that were described by our friends at the Roe Foundation remind me that education is always paramount in disability life. The fact is, myths and misperceptions about disability only exist so long as no one dares to lift the veil and ask those questions. We can go into any place in the world and find disabilities. That's not a problem. But having an understanding that there are going to be different views and different perspectives on them. That can be a little harder. Keeping an open mind is essential. Going in, not judging what another group may believe, but offering education and insight can be a great advantage. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.